Welcome to Seize the GM, a show about how to seize the GM seat and run with it. I'm your host, Zendead.
I'm your co-host, Jules.
And I'm the other co-host, Null Operations.
Have you ever had a great idea for a campaign? Do you have a bunch of friends who want to play an RPG but have no one to run it? You want to see what the world is like behind the GM screen instead of in front of it?
Well, we're here to help you do just that. Each week, the three of us are going to discuss various GMing topics. Terminology, maps, atmosphere, world building, you name it. So sit back, relax, and let's hit that GM seat hard. Banter, banter, banter.
That will never get old, my friend.
I know. One of these days I'll actually get the setups to start doing that right.
Someday.
Yeah.
One of these years, right?
Yeah. As soon as I sit down and actually take the time on one of my days off. But we are talking about whatever. And the reason, one of the reasons why I have not gotten it done is I played Skyrim like all day today.
Why?
Special edition came out.
Oh, I've got the high def like PS4 version. It is so fucking sexy. I pretty much ran through almost all of the Dawnguard DLC.
No spoilers.
Today.
Still never done that.
Oh my god, it's so amazing. That building houses, it is so much fun. It is like the best game ever for that.
It's pretty
solid. Yeah, that's what I've been doing.
I hate that shit. I'm playing Fallout 4, and the building, I hate that part.
Really?
Oh, I fucking despise it.
I played the original New Vegas mod that caused them to bring that into the game in the first place.
I know. I will never put that mod. I fucking hate it.
Oh, God, no. The one in Skyrim is really sexy.
Well, it's Skyrim, dude.
Yeah.
It's a Bethesda game.
Yeah. Yeah, but they did it. They did a really good job, and they keep up on making sure that it looks good still.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, other than that, I also painted a bunch of minis.
You need to put more pictures up.
I need to put any pictures up, but Friday I'm going to buy my cardboard box so that I can start building my light box to shoot pictures in.
Ooh.
Nice.
Yeah, I've got a couple of big high wattage light bulbs, and I've got a white thing to go over like where the holes are going to be cut so that I can actually place it inside of there with a white background, and they'll look really sharp when they're done.
Neat.
So yeah, but I did like, I painted three minis on my game. They're about ready to end like this weekend. We're going to finish book two of Shattered Star.
Nice.
They have one fight left. So.
Ooh.
Yeah, they are at the boss fight. So I'm basically going to build the room that they're going to fight in, building the bed that's in it. And I went out and bought a special mini just for her. So it's going to be pretty sexy when it's all done.
Yeah, it is.
So.
That sounds pretty darn cool.
Yeah. Then that's it. I'm
lucky.
Done. Yeah.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Well, one of these days I'll actually be able to. I've got a pretty stable group right now of three. I really wanted a fourth that's stable, and I'm never gonna find it around Knoxville.
The problem is you're looking for stable game.
I know. Oh, I talked to a guy. I'm not going to say any names, but I talked to him, and he was our group missing one session in like the last month. He basically said, well, that's, you guys are not stable. And the fact that you can't give me a an end date for when you're going to run, but you said 6 months, and 6 months is just too soon for me. I want longer games. And I'm like, dude, they've been playing for 6 months already in this one. And if a year isn't long enough in one of these, then sorry.
It depends. I mean, I've had some games that have lasted that long, but it is kind of nice sometimes to have like a nice short game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm a fan of compact campaigns. Like, if I've got an idea to run a campaign that's like 8 sessions, that's what I want to run. And just call it 8 sessions and be done.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So.
Yeah, but I was like, the long. I like having the long drawn out stories, but having like little sub stories within, you know, I like that a little bit better. Mm-hmm. But with the big overarching story, you don't even know that it's part of it until, you know, big climax at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I personally much. Like they're hard to set up and you really need a long-term table to do. But I always like the where you feel like you're having a bunch of small sessions, like, you know, 2-3 month-long campaigns, but the Game Master has managed to combine them all to one big meta story that might even, like, go across systems.
Yep.
I always love that.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. But we're... Yeah, I have had such a problem with finding players that are stable enough to be able to do something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm lucky because I know I've got maybe 3 people. If one guy, my buddy Peter, I love him to death. He's awesome. And I have to make sure he's scheduled in advance. You know, I can't do, you know, like a last minute pickup. But if he puts it on his schedule, he can do it, but he does have certain chunks of time where he's just, I can't do anything, especially right now with the holidays comes up, because he's in, like, in a holidays play, lack for a better term for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of my other friends, you know, have to coordinate babysitting. And, you know, but the thing is, like, the one thing I like is once we have a schedule kind of, like, knocked in and not moving, we're set. The problem is if something kind of derails it a little bit, it's really tough to get them back into that nice little, like, pocket, you know, and that little niche.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I completely agree with that.
But we are not here to talk about games and the things that we want to do with games. We are here tonight, instead, to talk about books that belong in your GM library. In addition to whatever games you're running. These yeah. are just things that you need to have, because, folks, you will learn very quickly that you need to do this.
Yeah, it's kind of... What it does is it allows you to pull from a whole bunch of other different things. Like, what do you want to study? To be a good GM, everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing that can't be used in some way to enhance your gaming in some way. And it sometimes it might seem stupid or frivolous. Like, believe it or not, even children's nursery rhymes. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff you can pull. You know, so yeah. You don't have to, like, say, oh, well, you know, I don't need to study, you know, I don't need to know much about agriculture. Well, for playing D&D, you know how much extra flavor you could throw into that game with it?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's that kind of thing. So,
yeah, you
don't
never
exclude
know,
something.
You never know what will be important. So having a really broad base helps. Even if you don't know a lot about everything, if you know a lot about a few things and you've got kind of a smattering of other things, that can do nothing but help a game.
A lot of it also has to do with, you know, world building in general that these books can provide.
Yeah.
Just, you know, not just in terms of fiction, but, you know, books that describe our real world and seeing where they connect.
I think what we're going to do is we're going to each tackle 3 books. We're going to explain why it's important. and have just a couple of minutes on each book. That way we're not, because folks, there are hundreds upon hundreds of books. We put together a big list, which we're going to keep going back to and giving you guys additional books and how we think they can be used.
Yeah, this is Appendix Episode 1, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, though, the nice thing about all of us having a whole bunch of extra books in our back pocket that, you know, we hopefully will use or have used in the past, you know, so you have to keep listening if you want to get the entire list. And it is quite extensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So kind of a little nudge right there.
So let's get started.
All right. No, go ahead. Start us off.
Okay. I'm going to start with The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. So we cover a lot of fantasy here. We cover sci-fi to a degree. You know, mystery is one of those things that is a good foundation for a D&D campaign or a World of Darkness campaign. Because, sure, you have fights and all that, but you need something to drive those fights forward. And a good mystery is a place to start. The Big Sleep can be a good inspiration for that. You know, you're talking about a book that serves as the foundation of the kind of noir detective theme. And, you know, it's a lot of fun in that regard. The also shows off the premise of putting out plot hooks that don't necessarily lead anywhere, just to kind of confuse your players.
The ever-infamous red herring. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great... Yeah, mysteries and learning how to tell a mystery is its own almost reward if it's done well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, especially if you make sure to give the players enough to find the answer, but never quite tell them directly. So, all right. For me.
Jules, go.
He's playing, not it.
I know.
Ninja. All right. First thing I'm picking is the Fable series by Bill Willingham. It's actually one of the coolest things I have read. It's a unique take. I'm sure you guys all know the premise of Once Upon a Time or, you know, those kind of TV shows. Mm-hmm. Well, Bill Willingham was doing that kind of stuff in comics, you know, prior to that coming out, if I recall correctly. I might not be wrong. Who knows? But the nice thing about it is it takes fairy tale characters, fable characters, and not just from Great Britain or American folklore like Ichabod Crane. It actually has, you know, some Middle Eastern fables, some Japanese fables, the characters, and their essence of what they are and who they are has been distilled so well that when you take all these characters and you put them into New York, at least is where I think it is, the characters are still the same, but because of something horrible happening in their lands, they have to make it work over here. And there's some really tricky rules. So one of the big things is like animal fables, like, you know, the Three Little Pigs or Mr. Toad from Wind in the Willows. They have to have glamour on them to look like humans, otherwise they're sent to the farm. Humanity shouldn't seem it puts the entire group at risk. But the thing is, it's really good to find it. I guess the way it is, like, if you're doing something in someone else's universe, you know, it's already established canon, like you're doing something in Serenity, you're doing something in Star Wars or Star Trek. And it shows a really great example of how to take these characters that we all know, we all love, and they're, you know, they're very, very, like, the Big Bad Wolf. In the comics, he's Big B Wolf, which is totally awesome. And the essence of their personality is the same. And, you know, they react how we remember that they would react. You know, the Little Mermaid's in there. It's awesome. So, And it shows how to take characters like that and use them in a completely random and whacked out setting. So, in ways, like, seeing that, it helps, you know, the GM use established characters. You wanted Jane from Firefly to show up in your Firefly game, even just in passing. It shows how you can do that without completely, you know, overwriting somebody else's characters, that's the one thing you do have to worry about, is because they're timeless characters, and if you're not playing it quite right, so you really have to understand them. And reading those comics kind of show you how it's done. You know, you can put your own twist on it, cool. But it, reading it, you kind of see, what can I mess with and what can't I?
Sure.
You know, and I think for anybody, especially if you're playing in someone else's sandbox kind of thing, where like the whole universe is so well, like Star Wars, but not quite anymore because all the other stuff is now said to be non-canon and midichlorians, blah. But you get the point.
So yeah. Taking that inspiration, we are now going to play Wild West Werewolf, except we're going to add in Hunter the Reckoning and Billy the Kid.
No.
No?
No.
No. Hand of Jesse James.
There you go.
We need the hand of Jesse James, because that's just awesome.
Ooh, let's add in Tombstone.
Ooh. All right, Zen Dad. You've been hanging out.
Well, we are going to start with, because we usually tackle fantasy as a general thing, we're going to instead talk about the first science fiction novel by a very famous female author named Mary Shelley, and the book is Frankenstein.
Mother of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Taking how you can push what is just at the edge of new and extrapolating out just a touch. Because that's all that she really did, was took one element and said, electricity, which was kind of new, and said, what if that actually brought people back to life after seeing them, like, electrocuting frogs and stuff and making them jump? Well, what if there was enough? I mean, that's the whole premise of it.
Yep.
Now, take that and apply those same ideas to whatever science fiction you're going to run. The what's just on the edge of new.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty much what science fiction really kind of boils down to. Those things that are either that or they're so far out there that it's almost hard to tell what they are.
The thing is, it makes the scientifically extraordinary, they take it and they make it a mundane part of their world, where yeah. This is what it is. And, you know, and the characters interact with it as it, you know, this is standard, I'm used to it, mm-hmm. You know, and making it so natural that yeah. We could actually kind of put ourselves there in Star Trek, tri-quarters, you know. We could actually, they used it. It was so mundane, and we could actually see them doing it. Now we're seeing it, you know, yeah. Or the communicators, a.k.a. now smartphones.
Yep.
Yeah. And the cool thing, though, is because of just science, you know, back around Mary Shelley's time, they would actually have, like, I'm going to show you science arenas, and people would buy tickets and watch people do science.
Yeah.
It was a little bit more myth-bustery science than, you know, rigor. But it made so many people think. So it's just yeah. Like by bringing science to the masses, we get the first piece of like science fiction / horror. You know, horror not yep. In like the Kruger sense, but for me, it's
gothic.
Know. And thing is, like for me, is like it was the villain was never who you thought exactly was. Everyone's like, oh, it's the monster, kill the monster, when Victor Frankenstein himself was the monster, and I yeah. Found that, and the...
Justin.
Alrighty, well, covered mysteries, and I think I'm going to move on to... Well, since you did science fiction, I'll do science fiction too. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series by Douglas Adams.
Well done, sir, you hoopy frood.
Well, the reason I picked this series is because... It shows how to twist a genre, where, as you covered with Frankenstein, how you can twist the future a little bit, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy twists what we know about a genre in terms of taking what's familiar in it, space flight, aliens being aliens, and turns it on its head, spins it sideways, gives it a martini, and sends it on its merry way.
Yeah.
I've never heard it given that kind of a comment before, but I like the martini.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you need a little bit of drink. So, mm-hmm. The book is a lot of fun. It also gives you a little bit of world building, because there's a lot of snippets in it where they just kind of step away from the story and look at the, as title mentioned, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, to just kind of get these little world building snippets that don't necessarily matter to the story, but they kind of give you the why something is that way in the story. Like the, you know, fishes that let you hear every single language, and how their creation is surely proof of God, despite the fact that there are these books about God not existing. There's actually 3 books in that series, too. So,
yeah,
it's a lot of fun. It's definitely worth, well, really, in any way you want to listen to it or read it. Because not only is it a book series, there's an audio series, radio play series, 2 movies? Just 1. I forget.
I think there were 2.
One.
See,
I think
isn't
one
there
of them
a
was
TV
a
major... series?
Yes, thank
there's
you.
There's a TV series,
right,
too.
Right.
Yeah. So, plenty of ways to enjoy it. All of them are different, and that's on purpose.
Yep.
So.
All right, Jules.
Nah. Yeah, you're mean to me. All right. Next one, believe it or not, I'm picking more of a what?
I'm sorry. I thought I'd cut it off at the past.
Ah. Now, what I'm thinking about is not exactly a book, but a type of book, and I'm picking books of fables. Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories, Aesop's Fables, and the like. One reason is the biggest reason is that it shows that all actions have consequences and a lesson therein. And they don't need to be huge, convoluted, complicated things to have the lesson, you know, pretty much sit in your face and gyrate. You don't have to worry about that. They're simple, but I don't want to say they're not preachy, because a little bit they are, but you can relate to each and every one of them. And I like that. So, reading that, when your players are doing something, you know, it doesn't have to be morality play, but most players do need to realize that actions have consequences. And you see some of this goofy stuff in Dark Souls. Like, you make a choice, there's no going back, control Z, and undoing it.
Right.
So, you know, that's the one thing I like.
Yeah.
More or less.
But yeah, those are great, because they're just snippets. They give you ideas to work from.
And you can always, and the thing is, you can actually take a fable and then twist it just enough so the fable itself fits your story.
Yeah.
You know, if you can actually use it to help coach your players. Like, if you've got a, remember way back we talked about player types?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now imagining you're having like a bit of in-character, like, kerfuffle between a couple of players, you know, having, you know, I can't remember which fable it was, but it was, people are judged by the company they keep. So if you got one guy in the group that keeps screwing everything up, having it come down on the entire party and see if there can be some kind of way to show, it's a way to show not just that one kind of frustrating player, but the rest of the team that there's going to be consequences to this. And just because they didn't do anything, they weren't naughty, it still can come back and bite them in the butt.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's something really important to remember. Your turn.
All right, I'm going to stick with something very similar to this, but I'm going to do it for a different reason. And that is Far Eastern myths. You should find, there's many different books on different mythologies for all of the different countries and everything else. Picking up even just a few of the stories from any of them from the Far East or from India on. Like, I consider that, you know, everything from like Vietnam all the way up through Mongolia, all the way out to, you know, Japan and everything else. And actually even some of the Polynesians. Learn some of those myths, because those myths will help you to not be so uninclusive in your games, because the real world is filled with so many different cultures and skin colors and everything else. If you start thinking about using things like that in your game, it will force you, just by being exposed to it, to include more people of color, of genders, I mean, everything. It will start to, you'll just want to start incorporating those if you're creating a living, breathing world. And that's why that is so important to do, because to make a real world that feels like it's always moving.
Oh, yeah.
And the cultures of it are always doing something. Those things need to happen for it to work.
I would highly recommend for a book in that particular set, Journey to the West. A lot of our listeners are probably of age that they've watched the show Dragon Ball. The character Goku is based off one of the protagonists from that book, Sun Wukong.
Hmm. Awesome.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And there's actually kind of a neat thing going off of the Journey into the West thing, the story of Hanuman, is that in India, there's similar stories, and you can see kind of also how the mythos changed as it moved from India to China.
Yeah.
And then stories came back, and they kind of branched, but they have all these wonderful, interesting, similar elements.
Yeah.
And you could see how it's actually kind of interesting, the same kind of, you know, adventure stories and what have you can be, have their own cultural significance. I love it.
Yep. And that's why you should do stuff with them.
Totally.
I mean, I did this as just one, but yeah, get into every mythology book you can get your grubby little paws on and devour them. Seriously. I mean, it helps.
For those of our listeners who actually have little paws and fangs big enough to eat books, please don't actually literally eat the books, read them.
Yes, right. Yes.
Then eat them later if that is your appetite.
Yes. All right. So, Justin, what you got next?
I am rounding out my three suggestions with, well, you pick the large subject. I'll pick a reasonably large subject group. The writing of Stephen King.
That is a very large subject group.
Yes. I pick Stephen King's writing because, to me, one of the important things about his writing is you have all these vignettes about sub-characters in the settings. These little side characters that help make the setting a bit more rich in terms of why something is this way, explaining the context of this magic or this monster. It gives us a reason to learn more about the world without necessarily directly affecting the characters. And this could be brought into gaming in terms of the players seeing a video or reading a scroll or an account, a way of kind of shooting some lore into their lives without necessarily forcing them into things that might kill them or that they don't want to necessarily do. Plus, it's good fun writing in a lot of complex different settings and weaving stories together of different genres.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jules.
All right. Last one. It's not a book. What? It's a web series.
Cheating.
And
that's cheating.
No, it's not. Hey, you like my little fear stuff. You ain't going to knock this one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, let's just put it this way. This show, it's actually called Extra Credits. It's on YouTube. And it's, believe it or not, mostly about video game design. But the thing is, some of the really high overarching comments, well, their commentary, their insights, their descriptions, they have a wonderful thing. They do it every year on horror. So they do on horror protagonists, horror antagonists, like the monster. You have like the monster that's not seen. They have the monster that themselves is the villain, and the timeless monsters, you know, like Frankenstein's monster or Dracula and what they kind of represent. And it's brilliant. They do a bit on how to build, you know, believable characters, Myers-Briggs, all these wonderful, wonderful things, not just on, you know, yes, they always have like the, you know, bits specifically for video games, but even some of their insights there, like your game is never really finished. So if you're creating something, what you're creating is never really going to be finished. It just has to be done. And it was a really interesting thought and a take on that that I never thought about before. Because I come up with, actually, this upcoming stat block, I will let you know that's one of the things. I'm like, yeah, it's not done. It's not finished. It's not right. I'm like, well, it's all right. It's got to be, you know, okay, this is good enough. Not saying like it's a low, shoddy product, but you're always going to keep thinking back and then trying to fix it, going back and trying to fix it. And that'll take up way too much of your energy.
Yeah.
You know, they go into what creates a world, how you can do little tips and tricks when you're building your world, when you're describing it, to make things a little bit more immersive. And yep. You could take these lessons and apply them everywhere. So I highly recommend these guys.
Awesome.
You know? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the one other thing I like is also they have games you might not have tried. The interesting thought on video games. And the one thing also is they do have a wonderful also bit on it. They had an episode called Standing Up for Our Medium. And I actually think that's really good, especially with the future being so uncertain. It gives you insight on, you know, because games right now, all tabletop and video, people are looking them sideways like, that's the reason so-and-so did something terrible. And it gives you tricks on how to stand up for it. And as a GM, since you are running the game, you're kind of seen as the de facto, quote, head of the group. So, yeah. You know, that, nice. That one was a good episode, so. All right. Bring us home, buddy.
All right. So, I am going to hit another science fiction book, actually.
We all seem to love science fiction, don't we?
Yep.
I do love reading it. I don't enjoy most games in sci-fi. But it's weird. I'm a strange little bird like that. But the book that I'm going to talk about is Dune by Frank Herbert. The first Dune, and only that book. Because because the rest of it gets into weirdness that is many, 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 many books have been written about the series. And by his son and everything else. Basically, Dune does some really neat things with its world that it's built. And it took foundational cultures that existed on our world, and Frank changed them. Sometimes very subtly, but they were changed enough that you couldn't tell where they originated from. Because he changed only maybe one or two aspects of it. Something even as weird as just the color of their skin changed the cultural context that it was written in. Because if you think about it, the Fremen are nothing more than the Saharan tribesmen living off of the land. Change their skin color, add a little more, not much mysticism more,
mm-hmm.
and drop them into this world that he's created, and that's them. Just by changing that one thing of skin tone, and then dropping them in, it changed them so radically that it's hard to tell where they came from originally. So that's why that book is good. And also they're like, they changed the Catholic Church in it.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the early stuff is all based on Catholic-ish doctrine type things, but he's changed enough of it that it's hard to tell. So,
yeah, you kind of have to look a little harder.
Yeah, but that's one that you have to look more at. But yeah,
but he did it so subtly that you'll understand it on a subconscious level. But yeah. You really have to kind of, you're like, I get it. Why?
Yeah, yeah, and that's one of the beauties of it. I mean, so taking things like that, learning from that aspect, and then applying those things in your game. You could end up with like a troop of like a culture of dwarves that are freedom fighters that are based on like the Jewish freedom fighters of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And they change it. It's a racial thing that's now a religious racial, and you've just shifted it enough.
And it's hard to see where it is.
Neat. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that is going to wrap up our 9 books for this time.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to kick into stat blocks. I'm going to get those like blocks hitting each other. I have them. I have the recording of it. It's good. I just have to put it together on my phone. But since we know Jules has got a long one, Justin.
Mm-hmm. I'm out this week.
You're out this week. And I have a short one, so we're going to go ahead and do my short one here. And they are called The Unspoken. The Unspoken are a group of highly trained and specialized warriors for the Queen. They are never seen unless the Queen is threatened, and then they appear from the shadows of the throne room. Since the Queen is a widow and has no champion, she needed a way to protect herself. So she spoke with her spymaster. The result is the Unspoken. They are taken from the finest guard and then trained in a secret location known only to the spymaster. Their membership is secret and very small. They train as a unit of 5. There are 3 units in total that rotate duty. The head of each unit reports to the spymaster and the Queen only. No one has ever seen any of them speak aside from the head of a unit. Now, the truth is that they've actually all been muted so that they can never speak. They've created a unique system of hand gestures as well as facial tics to convey everything that a normal language could. There is at least one of them that can do spell casting as well, and it's not always the leader. Doom, doom, doom.
Well done. Very creepy.
I actually am using them in my homebrew world. I needed somebody that was unique and different, and I wanted to find a way to use the ninja class from Pathfinder.
Really?
Yeah, like they're all ninjas, but you would never know.
Well, I don't know. Super secretive. I think I can see how they could be ninjas.
Well, except they're all, like, from a not Eastern, like, the country that they're actually in is completely non-Eastern. It's almost French.
French ninjas.
Yeah. I'm imagining that. I like it, though.
I do. So,
all right. Jules.
All right.
Bring it in.
Well, yeah, Null, you are the reason I wrote this, because you dared me last time, so... Yeah, you're suffering for this one. Have it creep in your head.
It was because you didn't have anything last time.
Yeah, but this is the reason it's a Little Fears item.
I know.
Creep in your head, may this haunt your nightmares. Oh, in Little Fears, kids use, and I'm using bunny rabbit ears, stuff to fight monsters and help save the world. One of these items is called the All-Seeing Camera. All the powers aren't known to the child yet, but they'll find them. This camera used to belong to the child's dad. It was a big part of their life from the first breath. It took baby pictures, pictures on vacation, family photos, birthday photos. It held the memories of the family. Happy memories, and some sad ones. Then one day, coming home from a wonderful vacation, everything changed. It was dark, and it had been raining. Dad couldn't maintain control of the car. The child doesn't remember what happened after that. The child then went to live with Auntie and Uncle while Mom and Dad were recovering in the hospital. Auntie and Uncle lived in suburban Massachusetts. But since the child was away from all that they knew, they were allowed to take the camera with them, taking a little piece of home and the happy memories that come with it. It's now fall, and things aren't feeling right. A wisp in the corner of the eye, a cold breeze, a strange noise. Well, while doing the fall tour of local historic sites with Auntie and Uncle, the kid decides to be just like Daddy and take some pictures. Putting the camera up to their eye, getting ready to take a picture of a statue, the child sees something through the viewer. A skeletal form overlaying the statue. It disappears when they stop looking through the viewer. Putting it back up to their eye, it reappears. The apparition overlaying the statue notices the kid can see it, and it disappears. So that's the initial power of the all-seeing camera, seeing the invisible. The more the child uses it, the more powers are discovered. The ability to blind monsters with a flash. The ability to have others experience everything the child experienced when they took that picture. And then, there's a very special feature of the camera. But it's dangerous. If things go wrong, the consequences can be death. The feature is called save. What happens is when someone is hurt, no matter how badly, taking a picture of the person will heal them, restoring their health and their vigor, and correcting any negative effects they may have received. The memory card in the camera saves the damage. However, storage devices are finite, and since the crash, the memory card in there was fused. You can't get it out. It's currently unknown how many saves are on that storage device and how much space is left. When the storage device is full, all the damage that was saved explodes outward, returning the damage to its original owner. Bones re-break, gaping wounds reopen, and the kids rescued from the brink of death find themselves back at the brink, staring into oblivion once again. The camera is a useful tool and a powerful one, and it can even save someone from imminent death. But every bit of magic has its cost and a risk. What are you willing to pay?
Nice. That's pretty damn creepy.
Like I said, blame Justin. You know, I came up with, you know, nicer things in the past. This one, like I said, this is my wheelhouse, but it gets a little creepy.
Yeah. You know, if I'm getting blamed for creation of things like that, I will happily take the blame.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, it's as much as I love all the other games that I play, the one I can create best for is horror. Not the epic Call of Cthulhu horror, but Are You Afraid of the Dark Plus? So that's you know, that's where I really can shine.
So. Nice. Yeah.
All right, so Professor Zendead, teach us a word.
All right, we're going to talk about our lexicon, which is such a fun thing to do.
Where's the paper sound effect? I can't find the file.
I know.
Shoot.
I've got it. Okay. I've got it. I'm going to work on this probably next week.
You got this.
Soon.
All right. Yeah. And the word for today is penology. It is a noun, and the definition is, does anybody happen to know?
Study of pens and pen-like accessories.
No.
No.
I'm not going to get the other pen thing.
Farming enclosures.
Oh. No. Actually, it is a branch of criminology that deals with prison management and the treatment of offenders.
Huh.
They have a video game about that now.
I own the game. Yeah.
The origin is it's Greek and English. Basically, penalty and the study of.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which, ology is the study of, so.
Yep.
The Greek is poine, which is penalty. And its first known use was 1838. So, around the time that they started, I guess, massively incarcerating people. Which I guess is a good thing to know, or not a good thing to know. But that wraps up our illustrious and ever infamous lexicon. So, let's
get some...
At least
you're picking words that we can at least all pronounce.
Oh, God, there are some that I don't, though. I love doing those, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like I love the fact you're using awesome words, but... You know, With the holidays all coming up, even after we've had one too many Chardonnays, we could probably still pronounce them.
Yeah, some of these, yeah. All right, so let's go ahead and get our closing remarks in. And what are you going to shout out there, Justin? You've been quiet.
Quiet, subjective. Well, I have been diving deep into Final Fantasy of late.
Okay.
Particularly Final Fantasy XIV. And the reason being is that I've been realizing just how complex the lore of Final Fantasy XIV has been. So much so that I've actually sought out videos kind of explaining the lore more.
And oh, nice.
I found a channel on YouTube by a user by the name of Ethis Asher, who has basically been taking the Final Fantasy lore, mostly around 14, but a few of the other Final Fantasies, and seeing how it stacks up against the real-world context that it's based off of. Comparing things like deities of Greek and Middle Eastern descent, and how fantasy has brought them in as these legends and these kind of neat world-building things that kind of ties into the book stuff we were talking about earlier. So
it's
been a lot of fun reading it. I get kind of addicted to it, and I'm thinking and watching these videos more than I'm actually playing the game.
That's funny.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
That's a good proof. That it's good, is if it, you're more interested in finding out about the lore than actually playing the game at sometimes, then...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Heck yeah.
Alright, Jules, what you got?
Alright, same thing, but different. The audiobook is called Ripoff. The physical book is called Mashup. And it is one of the coolest concepts I've, pretty much ever listened to. It's a collection of short stories narrated by different narrators and they're written by different authors. The thing is that each author had to start with the book had to be in the public domain,
mm-hmm.
but take the opening line, like Moby Dick, call me Ishmael, and then weave a story from it.
Oh, that's cool.
So my personal favorite, I love Mike Resnick. Mike Resnick is probably one of my more recent bingey authors where it's just like, oh, yes, get in my brain. But there's a story in there, and it's called The Evening Line. There's a character, main character is called Harry the Book. Now, if any of you guys know the book or the musical Guys and Dolls, take that kind of aesthetic. And then add magic, zombies. So, you get Gently Dawkins. Joey Chicago is the bartender. And it's brilliant. He has all these wonderful, wonderful characters. Plug Malone. He's a guy that won big at horse racing at the Aqueduct. So, finds out he wins all this money.
That is such all these, a book character name.
I know.
Yeah,
and the thing that's brilliant is the first line and what book he pulled it from. Pride and Prejudice. You take the first line of Pride and Prejudice and then spin a Harry the Book story around it? Are you kidding me? It's brilliant.
That's great.
And the nice thing is, they have a little intro. I listen to the audiobook because, it's great when I drive. But here's the thing that's fantastic, is that before each short story, they have the author, most of them, read a little blurb as to what they took and why they used it and how they got the inspiration for it. And I was just like, oh, it was brilliant. And I heard that one story. I'm like, okay, stop. I'm not listening to the rest of the book. I'm listening to that one again before I continue on.
That's so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that
mm-hmm.
is really good.
Yep. So awesome. Zendad, what you recommended for us?
All right, it's a musician actually.
Ooh.
He goes by the name The Enigma TNG.
The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he is on YouTube. He's also on Bandcamp. The intro and outro music that we are going to be using after this episode is actually one of his pieces. I accidentally found him because I was looking for cyberpunk-ish music for Shadowrun because I wanted to run it while I was... And there's stuff that's like, I think one of his is like 12 hours of just mashup stuff, like just multiple songs just bunched all together. And he's got like a huge number of discography, like albums and stuff. It covers everything from like dubstep to electronic to kind of trancey to kind of ambient. I mean, it's kind of all over. And it's really fun. And the guy himself is actually really hilarious to watch his, like, when people are like, when he hit, like, I think 50,000 subs on YouTube, he promised that he'd do a video. And he was just like, I don't even know what you guys want me to say. Thanks. he's just a dude that lives outside of Philly, I think, and he's super nice, and yeah,
unbelievably talented.
He is really good.
Oh, check his stuff out.
Yeah, there will be links in the show notes.
Yes,
because his YouTube stuff is there's more of it there than anywhere else. He's on Bandcamp, but the number of things on Bandcamp is small. It's weird. Most of his stuff is on YouTube. So, and I'm surprised he hasn't been like snatched up by a label yet with some of his stuff.
Here's hoping.
Yeah, it'd be nice. It'd be really cool. So that is going to give us our show, folks. So we are going to hit the old outro button and let it run. And we will see you guys in 2 weeks, because with the holiday season, we're going to take that week of Thanksgiving off.
I got a lot of cooking to do the night before. No way.
yeah, right.
You know, you get most of the stuff mostly prepped, so all you got to do is throw in the oven for the last bits.
Oh, that's smart. I usually just run around with my hair on fire.
Yeah, see, we're doing fondue.
Ooh.
Right now, downstairs, I'm smelling I've got the brine cooking.
Oh.
I cook the brine for a day, let it cool, and then I start the turkey.
That makes sense.
Yeah, now we're doing that, and then we're doing, for Christmas, we did this last year, and we went to a Brazilian steakhouse for Christmas dinner.
Awesome.
Sweet.
Yeah, so I think we're doing that again this year.
Are those like the type of places where like you raise a little flag when you want meat and they just come down and meat?
There's a disc that you just flip, green or red, that's next to you.
Oh, that's going to be brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, God, we did it last year. It was so good. I ate way too much food.
That, there's no such thing, but okay.
Yeah, well... I can put away a lot of food, so.
Fair enough.
But, all right, folks. So, in 2 weeks, we will get back, and we will see you then.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Have a safe one, everybody.
All right. You can contact us or the show using Twitter, Facebook, or regular old email. Twitter accounts are, mine is at Zendead.
I'm at Jules Podcaster.
And you can find me at Null Operations.
And the show's Twitter account is at SeizeTheGM. You can email me at Zendead at SeizeTheGM.com.
And me at jules@seizethegm.com.
And me at loperations@seizethegm.com.
We're also on Facebook. Find us at http://www.facebook.com/seizethegm. So thanks for joining us for this episode of Seize the GM. Feel free to leave a comment about this episode on our webpage, www.seizethegm.com. Let the dice fall where they may, and we'll see you again next week.
Seize the GM is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike 4.0 International License. All copyrighted material references herein are held by the respective owners. No infringement intended, and no claim of ownership is implied.
Music for this show is from Magnatune.com. Links to the artists will be in the show notes. Once again, we will see you next week.